Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 12, delivered on February 26, 2018. The title of this lecture is Bonds.
Today, bonds. This subject has a few extras in it. Aside from bonds, of course, I've told you that there are notes and bills. The lecture will somewhat focus on the bonds, but I do want to give you a couple of insights into other debt instruments. Remember, the debt holders have the prior claim, and the stockholders, the common and preferred stockholders, have the residual claim. Along the way, to bonds, which are the long-term debt instruments, I'll make a few comments about other kinds of debt instruments and be a little broader, or be a little bit more granulated in talking about bonds. First of all, when companies borrow money, they'll borrow money for all kinds of different term lengths they can. For example, anytime the government or a corporation borrows long-term notes or bonds, it'll be a situation where I will borrow the money from you. I am the issuer, you are the investor. Now, it will have on there a coupon. That is a percent of the face value. Now, you will get that coupon every year until the bond matures, and then at the end you'll get one last coupon payment and you will get your money you lent me back, the face value. Do you remember what the face value of a bond is? This is definitely one of the things you need to get a tattoo, okay? A tat right here against, right above your knee. Face value equals $1,000, always. Bonds are issued in multiples of $1,000. So I will not tell you the face value of a bond unless it would be something weird other than $1,000. However, if it's a short-term debt instrument, now remember, long-term money is from the capital market. Short-term money is from the money market. If it's short-term, a year or less, it will have, typically, it will be what we call a discount instrument. So for example, I want to borrow from you money. I'll pay you back $1,000 in a year. Well, the way you'll do it is you'll lend me something less than $1,000, and then the $1,000 you get back, the difference between what you lent me and what I give you back is your interest. That's called a discount security. Now, they can be of very short length. A good example, a very large market exists for what is called commercial paper. It's a very short-term borrowing issued by a large credit-worthy corporation. And it will have something like this. Give you an example. MSFT issues commercial paper. Well, let me put it this way. 30-day commercial paper at 99.618. I don't even have to tell you how much. It could be tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions. but it's going to be paid back within 30 days. It's like short-term working capital for the company. This is a wide, very large market. Lenders will lend MSFT $991.80 on the 1,000, and in 30 days, Microsoft will pay them back $1,000. Now, let me do the yield on it, and it's a classic. We have the ending value, 1,000, divided by the beginning value, $991.80. And then we would raise that to 1 over the number of years. Well, the number of years here would be 30 days divided by 365. And then don't forget to finish off by subtracting 1 from the whole mess. It's always end over beginning to the 1 over the number of years, and then the whole mess minus 1. Don't forget that minus 1 at the end. That's important. Now, let me pull up calculator here real quick. And hoping that that projector comes on here, clear. Seriously? Is it going to come on or not? Oh, there we go. Okay, so now I'm going to open up parentheses. 1,000 divided by $991.80. Close parentheses. Raise that to the open parenthesis, 1 divided by, open parenthesis, 30 divided by 365, close the parenthesis, minus 1. Before I do that, there's a little trick, and I found that it's useful, and most people don't know. When you're stacking parentheses, I mean, this one isn't that bad, but you can get to the point where you can't find the outhouse going 3 times around the barn. Watch the trick for knowing if you've got the right number of parentheses. Start with the first open. Every open, count 1 up. So we start 1, and then we close it. That brings us down to 0. Then we come to another open, 1, 2, 1, 0. Yeah, I've got the right number of parentheses. That's actually really useful in Excel when you've got stacks of parentheses, is to just be able to count up and count down. If you get back to 0, you probably got it. Okay, now, that's the annualized yield on that paper. That's actually pretty high for commercial paper. This kind of, and this is just another classic calculation of a yield on a non-yearly, non-one-year cash payment. A couple of parts, asides on this. Commercial paper is a vast market. Companies use it all the time. It is considered very safe because only large creditworthy corporations do this kind of thing. However, there have been a couple of times when large corporations run by scoundrels shook the market by defaulting on commercial paper, which of course drives, okay, it scares investors on all the commercial papers, so maybe for MSFT, they wouldn't lend 99.18, they'd go to 99.12, 99.10. In other words, they would cause the yield to go up because the default risk had gone up somewhat. The classic example of default on commercial paper was this corrupted firm at the very top ranks. They were within days of going belly up. I mean, serious, belly up. And the upper-level executives had been milking and skimming profit off this company for years, as it turned out. And they were moving the money to shell companies in the islands. And just a few days before they declared that they were dead, zero on cash, they issued a pile of commercial paper. And the market is so automated about it. Oh, here's a company that issued commercial paper. The investors, oh, yeah, go ahead and buy it. Yep. Didn't even think about what could happen. And this company, of course, went bankrupt. All that commercial paper paid off zero. And so that was a rather big shock to the market that a company would default on commercial paper. That company was Enron. And there have been a few other examples. However, as a general rule, the commercial paper market is considered a very safe market for very short-term investments. There are other short-term investments as well, very short-term, some super short-term. And I'm going to tell you about one right now. Now, in your lives, if you ran even a smaller type of business, you could take advantage of this. Truth be told, the bank is probably taking advantage of it without you knowing it, not giving you the money from it. But it goes back some years. Back when I was teaching at Wright State, back in the early 90s, I got to know some of the business people in town. And there was a fellow who ran a nice little insurance agency. He was the owner. Now, during the day, people would come in and they would pay their insurance premiums on their cars and their rent insurance and all that, homeowners insurance and all that kind of stuff. And by the end of the day, there would be a big pile of money. He'd have his assistant take it to the bank and deposit it. And of course, it would just sit there overnight. Wasn't going to be used overnight. He needed it, of course, during the day for paying bills, but at night, it just parked there doing nothing. And his bank, it was a pioneer in letting small business people do this. This was something that had been reserved for many, many years to rich people, to big corporations. But they were allowing smaller business entities to do it too. It's called a sweep. A sweep. Here's how a sweep works. The world is always alive. While you're sleeping on your CertaPro mattress, dreaming about sugar plums and all of that, the other side of the world is waking up. Earth is a clock, and it's always running. And so when you don't need money, the other side of the world does. So here's how it works. I'm your banker. You've put, let's say, $12,000 in checks and cash into the bank, and at 5 o'clock, you close. You won't need that money again until 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. So what I do on your behalf is I sweep that money out and I put it up into the global currency market. You do this with millions and millions of businesses, billions and tens of billions of dollars at any given time. So now you on the other side of the world have liquidity, as well as everyone else on the other side of the world. And then when you put your money into the account, when you go to sleep, then that money is swept out and it's available to you and the other people and businesses who are awake all through the day and night. So it's like this giant, the money market of the world is like a giant bladder. At any given time, funds are flowing into the market, being swept in, and funds are being swept out of the market on the other side of the world. And so the entire global economy at any given time has this massive hundreds of billions of dollars in money available to lubricate the engine of the world. Very cool. And it's something almost no one has any grasp of these literally vast insanely large currents of money flowing around the world at any given time, adding and providing liquidity to the global economy. This idea, they tell you, well, you're in a new era. It's a global economy. No, this isn't anything new. This has been going on for decades. Literally, to some extent, for centuries. And so, but it is there. Now, you understand this in the context of September 15th, 2008. In the morning, money by the tens of billions of dollars was being drawn out of the money markets. But it wasn't showing up anywhere. At 10 o'clock, it got so alarming that the Federal Reserve shut down withdrawals from the money market. At that point, it had already lost $550 billion. That bladder was basically going, and wherever it was going, it sure as hell wasn't going to add liquidity. It was draining liquidity, and the engine of the world economy was within a couple of hours of freezing up. And once the engine froze up, it would not come back on. That would be the end of it. All of the money in all of those sweep accounts and your money, in because the banks are sweeping your money without telling you and giving you part of the profit, it would have not been there anymore. It would have been gone. And the engine would not have come back on and just rebooted. It would not. That would have been the end of it. Right there. The end of essentially a world civilization on the financial side and on the social side too. So that's how close we came, 2 hours. Is it ever going to happen again? Well, no one said it would happen that time. It could happen like that time, and we barely missed the bullet. Okay, now, a little side note on this game. You see, the sweeps actually earn the client's money. It's not large, but it is something. So, madam, if you are a business person and you're putting in 12 grand every night, you're going to need that money from, let's say, 8 to 5. So you're going to need that money for 9 hours. The other 15 hours a day, that money could be earning you interest every day, 365 days a year. That's why sweep accounts are a nice thing, is because they allow people who put money into the bank but need it on a ready basis, but only at predictable times. This is the way to do it. A little variation on this, it's a con. It's played by some gas station chains and others like that, but it's gas stations who are the notorious for it. Suppose, what happens? You go to fill up your tank. Why go inside when you can put your debit card or credit card right here, right now? Oh, sure. The problem is, what they'll do is, let's say that your fill-up costs $40. They lock $100. Well, we just got to have enough in there so you can fill up your tank. But they don't unlock the other $60 for anywhere from 3 to 5 days. So they get to play with your money, put it into this kind of a trick. So if you got a gas station chain with 1,000 stations around the country, every one of them 100 customers a day doing this, and every one of them on average maybe $50 locked in, 100 times 1,000 is 100,000. $50, that's 5 million. 5 days in the hopper for that money. You give it back after 5 days, but for 5 days, at any given point, at any given time, money is flowing in, money is flowing out, but there's $5 million in the sweep earning interest for that company. It's your money, and they're earning interest on it because they're doing what we call playing the float. My European art agent, they will not pay me. They get the money, and they pay me 60 days later. You see the same trick? For maybe 400 artists, They can make a fortune just on the interest they play on the float, keeping their artist's money, their client's money, for 60 days until they turn it over. And then, of course, they take out their 33% commission. Damn their souls. Yeah. It's a tiny amount. You're right. It's super. It is super safe. But of course, remember that danger there. It has to do with frequency versus severity, which I'll bring up later in the course. But essentially, the frequency of losses is just extremely low. But the severity of a loss would be catastrophically global. The interest rate is maybe a fraction of a percent in a low interest rate environment. However, in a high interest rate environment, it gets to be a pretty respectable amount of money. And if you've got a company that is able to commit on a continuing basis for 14, 15 hours a day, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000, that's a lot of money. And it's a lot of interest that accumulates over a long period of time. And it is critical to the efficiency of the global currency markets, because this is what gives those markets its liquidity. It's an insanely large pool. It's highly diffuse. Let me tell you quickly, just a mention, I'm glad you brought this up. Frequency versus severity of loss. And I'll talk about this again later. But frequency, some things happen quite a bit, but they're very tiny things. You, sir, have molecules of oxygen hitting you around all the time. Okay? But very rarely would you have a giant intermediate vector boson come. Matter of fact, you probably never had it happen. Okay? Speaking as a ghost hunter, there are ghosts walking around all the time, and they just walk by you. Many, many of them. You're not interesting. But then there's this demon. I will eat your soul. You grease your hair. Yes. Okay? You understand how that is severe, but it's not going to happen too many times in your life. When you do have it happen, it's going to really impress you. A good example of this is right where we are right now. Earthquake insurance here is not very expensive because we don't have major earthquakes, except when we do. There's a fault line not too far from here. It's called New Madrid. Maybe every 200 to 500 years, it cuts loose. The last time was in the early 1800s. I read the stories, the people writing at the time, letters that they were writing from St. Louis area and up near Chicago, up along Quincy and all that. It was like something out of an apocalyptic science fiction. The earthquake was so powerful, they said the Mississippi ran backwards. No, actually it didn't. The land heaved upwards so heavily that it threw the water of the Mississippi back north, almost to Minnesota, and then it came back down like a tidal wave. So not only did you have the destruction and the fires from the earthquake, then suddenly a literal tidal wave had overcome the Mississippi, flooding land 10, 20 miles inland from the river. Won't happen very often, but if it ever does again, that's St. Louis, that's Kansas City, that's Indianapolis, that's Chicago, that's Memphis. Well, that's okay. Memphis sucks. That's everything. So it's not going to happen except when it does. Now, interestingly enough, I had it's probably been about 4 years ago. I had a fellow speak to my business club students, my finance club students, and he was talking about probabilities of different kinds of events. And he was showing major earthquakes, 6.8 or higher, right around here. And he's saying it's very small, so insurance premiums for earthquake insurance aren't that bad. But what was fascinating to me was that he was showing the historical probability chart they base those insurance premiums on. In 2000, the probability was put of a major earthquake at 0.005%. When he made his presentation, which was in 2000, it was in 2015, that was the probability had reached 0.05%. It's going up every year. And it's going up at an increasing rate every year. I asked him why that was, and he said he didn't know. He's not one of the people who does that. But something is making it so, even it's still very tiny. But if it does happen here, I will dismiss class early. I'll be the one out the door, and I'll lean back in and say, class dismissed. Anyway, there's that. Now, getting back to the main subject here, there are all kinds of flavors of bonds, different things you can talk about. One distinction among bonds is mortgage bonds, which are collateralized, so that if the borrower defaults, the lender can seize an actual asset. There's a liquidatable asset. Those are called mortgage bonds. You will issue, almost every one of you will issue a mortgage bond to buy a home, at least once in your lives. Then the other ones, which are not collateralized and therefore are riskier, so they have higher coupons, those are called debentures, D-E-B-E-N-T-U-R-E-S, debentures. D-E-B-E-N-T-U-R-E-S. You just wanted to see me screw that up, didn't you? Debentures. Now, here's an interesting variation. And this was something I actually didn't know about. I had my advanced degrees in finance. I went out there to do consulting. And there was so much important that I learned, but there was so much important that I had to learn in the actual real world. I got involved in oil and gas exploration down in Texas with a wildcat group. And there was one of the few times, we actually hit. It was not anything spectacular, you know, not like the movie spewing out of the ground, you know, this giant gusher. It oozed out and it stunk like hell and it was thick like mud. But it was there anyway, so of course we were going to have to pull rig that we'd rented and get the pump jack up, get the tanks put up and all that kind of good stuff. One of the two big dogs in the organization, he said, "You want to get the ETC?" And I was clueless. I had no idea what he was talking about. But being my usual jerk kind of self, pretending I knew more than I did, I said, "Do you do it this time? Because I don't know who you're going to do this with." And so, okay. He didn't even blink an eye. He just called up a bank, and he told him what we'd gotten and said, "I'm going to need an ETC, $300,000. And, well, there's a lot of extra expenses here. There was a back and forth about why it was so much. But it was issued. Bank had the check in the company's account within, 6 hours it was. And then I quickly found out what it was. ETC is a mortgage. It's like a mortgage bond. It is a mortgage bond, except that it is a special one, very standardized, and it's for equipment. And ETC stands for Equipment Trust Certificate. So it's a mortgage bond, but it's specifically for things like truck fleet, a crane, a pump jack, something like a helicopter. I don't know, a helicopter would be an ETC or not. But it's a very standardized instrument. It's like automatic bank. Oh, yeah, we'll get the ETC put together, all that kind of stuff. Money will be in your account. So it is a debt instrument. It is law. Actually, It just hit me. Those are more like notes because those were like five-year things, 3 to 5 year, if I remember right. But anyway, so an ETC is just a specialized kind of mortgage bond. Now, there are other kinds of bonds, too, and I'll bring up those in the next lecture. I mean, you've got serial bonds, gold bonds. One that I'll bring up here very quickly are municipal bonds. Now, a municipal bond is any debt instrument issued by a sovereign authority other than the federal government. Those are called treasuries if they're issued by the federal government. Anything below that would be a muni, a municipal. So, you, madam, are the mayor of Normal. And so you have, and the council have decided, we need a new sewer system. So you get a levy on the ballot, and the voters say, yes, we're tired of turds flying up the toilet. So you simply say, okay, we've got it approved. So you go to a specialized market that lends money to public entities, and you issue a municipal bond, a muni. Now here's a special thing. The interest, those coupons on a municipal, are tax exempt, the income is. They are not taxed at the federal level. That's why any of you in this room, unless you become insanely wealthy, you should never invest in a muni. Here's why. You are in the 15% tax bracket. Rich corporation, family trust, or person is in the 35% tax bracket. Now you can, each of you could invest in a 7% corporate bond. And you would be fully taxed at the federal level. So your after-tax yield is going to be 7% times 1 minus the 15% interest you'd pay. Seven percent times 0.85 is 5.6% is what you get after your after you pay taxes on the coupons. 5.6%. The wealthy investor will keep 1 minus 0.35. So the wealthy investor on a normal corporate bond, after taxes, he would keep 7 times 0.65. Oops. Municipal bonds will pay 4.55% to equilibrate them with the after-tax corporate bonds. You, as a low-income investor, would be insane to invest in it because you'd get 4.55%, which is less than you would get on a fully taxable corporate bond after taxes, which is 5.60%. So you should never invest in a muni. You shouldn't. Now, bottom line, that's one thing you've got to watch out for. If you invest in mutual funds, you'll invest in bond funds. Look through the manifest of their investments to make sure there are no munis in there. Because munis would mean that there's at least part of the portfolio is aimed at rich people. So you would be foolish to get involved in that. Just stay in the fully taxable corporate bonds. Because after taxes, you'll make more on the corporate bonds than you would on the tax-exempt munis. Now, going on with municipals here for a minute. They are considered generally fairly safe. Although they do have default premium in there because some munis have defaulted. The one that was the big shocker that sort of heralded the modern age of munis was Cleveland defaulting on a muni. That was some years back. Cleveland did. And of course, that rattled the market, and the coupons went up on munis because the risk of them went up. Then, of course, Detroit defaulted and a couple of other defaults. And here's the other part, too. Some states have so many financial problems that they have an extra risk premium for munis of anything in that state. Illinois has what is called the Illinois premium. The coupon on munis of anything in Illinois will be slightly higher than the coupons on munis that are not in Illinois, simply because there is of the financial problems we have here. California has a California premium. Interestingly, one that's come about in recent years is Wisconsin. They had such a big tax cuts and pro-business until they drilled themselves into the ground so hard that just like Illinois, the Wisconsin legislature finally had to say enough of this bull crap. Florida, yeah. So there is some munis offer a higher coupon because they're issued from states that have problems. And there's a higher risk of default, so the default premium is higher. Now here's another kicker. And this one, I mean, okay. It happened, it took effect in January of 2017. You see, when banks lend money, they lend money to people for homes, they lend money to businesses for things, they lend money to real estate projects, they lend money to schools. School bond levies, historically, the biggest lender, the biggest buyer of a school bond, a muni, were banks. Now, here's how it works with reserve requirements. The Federal Reserve requires a higher reserve for risky loans than it does for non-risky loans. Okay, so whereas the Fed would say you don't have to reserve any money if you buy U.S. Treasuries, they would say, all right, for loans that you make to homeowners to buy homes, you have to keep, let's say, a 5% on reserve. For loans to small businesses, maybe a little larger. For real estate investments, oh, those are pretty high. You got to keep a lot on reserve because those are risky loans. Historically, the Fed said that munis for schools were in their very low risk class. Banks don't have to keep a lot of money on reserve for munis that are build a school or something like that, buy a new fleet of buses, something like that. Well, as of January of 2017, the Fed said no more. School bonds must be kept, the reserves for those must be kept. The reserves are commensurate with a high-risk investment. In other words, school bonds are considered as risky as phony high-rise condo projects in Chicago. And, of course, the market for school bond issues has dried up. Banks don't want to lend the money because they have to keep so much on reserve when they lend that kind of money. In other words, they have to keep a lot of money that they can't do anything with just because they lend to schools. and no one knows why. Schools don't default. But somehow this idea that we've got to destroy the public school system in this country by whatever we can, whatever means we can, infected the Fed's mentality. And so there's a huge scramble going on. Schools are struggling to find lenders on bond issues. And of course, when you have to struggle to find lenders, you have to offer higher and higher coupon rates to attract the capital. And that's just what's happening. Higher coupon rates on school bond issues means that there is less money to actually build the schools and teach the kids. Higher taxes on the people in the community, on the property. So there you go. There's one of many, many stories. Munis are a whole book of stories in and of themselves. Now, down to the numbers. And again, I spare you a lot of the algebra theory, and I just say, let's get a couple of bonds priced. So in this case, typically, you will not know one of two things about a bond. That's how the problems are typically designed. You will either know the price and not know the yield, or you will know the yield and not know the price. So let me write one up here where we know the yield, what the market thinks this bond should pay. Let's say ACCN 5.8%, 2048, quoting at 98.52. Find the yield. Remember, you can know the price and not. So in this case, what we want to know is, what does the market think of this coupon? Before anything else, remember what I told you. Turn the coupon into dollars. That will save you getting it confused with the I percent. So in this case, now we're going to do this. Turn the calculator on again. Apps, Finance, TVM Solver. Now, remember what I told you is that in the real world, this $58 a year coupon will be divided into two payments. So the term here, 30 years, is actually 30 times two payments. So when we start this, don't forget to semi-annualize, unless you're told differently. Unless you are told differently, it's semi-annual. So N here is going to be a 30-year times 2. So there will be 60 coupon payments remaining. Leave the I percent alone. That's the yield we're trying to find. Now the PV is the current price value. Don't forget to put it in as a negative. And remember, that's a quote. You got to turn that into a dollar amount, which in this case, a quote of $98.52 is $985 and 20 cents. The payments are 58 divided by 2 each. And finally, the say what? What did I do? Yeah, I did. 58 divided by 2 is 29. Well, that's what it is. The payments are semi-annual, and everything follows from that. The payments are what are semi-annual. So everything else about it has to be adjusted to that. And so FV is your face value. Don't forget to put in the fact that there's a kicker at the end of every bond, $1,000. Now, before I finish, I'm going to go back up here and calculate the I percent. But before I do that, I wanted you to understand that you should be able to predict this. This bond is paying 5.8%. The market, which should price this bond at par, 100, is pricing it at 98.52. So the question would be simple. You, sir. Your mom says you're worth 100, but I'm going to pay only 98.52 for you. Does that mean that I think you're great, or does that mean I think you suck? Yeah. You see how the market is signaling that the coupon isn't sufficient? So we should see this yield, what the market says they pay, above 5.8%. Want to take a guess at what it is? It should, at 98.52, that's a little bit not very good, but we'll see. Alpha solve. Now, don't forget that this is a semi-annual yield. For heaven's sakes, multiply it by 2. I have more students fuss at me because they put down an answer. They forgot to do the times 2. Because everything you did was semi-annual. So the yield is going to come out as a semi-annual. So you have to... Oh, yeah? What the heck? How'd that go wrong? Times 2. Okay, 5.91%. Sure enough, the market said that bond should have paid 5.91%, pays only 95.8%. So we're going to sell it at we're going to drive the price down. There's going to be not enough investors until the price goes down, so that the price compensates for the bad coupon. Now, let me go on the other way. Let's try one this time. DTB 6.2%, 2038, quoting right now at 102.12. This time it's selling at a premium to par. This time it's selling at a premium to par. So we go up here. This one is going to be a 20-year times 2. Skip past that one. This time the price is negative 102.12. The payments are $62 a year divided by 2 for the semi-annual. Everything else is the same, so we're going to go back up to I percent. And this time, it's selling at a premium to par, so the market says 6.2% is too generous. Let's see. Alpha solve. Oh, my. I did what I always gripe it. It's 102.1.2. Gee. Whoops. Try it again. I've put in the quote instead of the price. Alpha solve. Now again, don't forget to times by two. Run it over. Times two. 6.02%. Sure enough, the market said you needed to pay only 6.02%. You're paying 6.2%. Well, investors are going to pour in to get this candy deal. A bond that's paying more than it needs to, investors are going to pour in, demand will go up, price will go up. That's how it works. Okay, now I'm going to give you a quiz. And when you're finished, that's all I have for you.